Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event with Elizabeth Strout. We thank LA Bay Book Company, as always, for inviting us to co-present this evening, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Okay, I'm going to turn things over to Rick Simonson from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce the rest of the program. Thank you.
At Elliott Bay, as well as here at the library, as Chris has said, I'm very much been looking forward to Elizabeth Strout, who is here tonight with this remarkable new novel, The Burgess Boys, the first book she's written since Oliver Kittredge came out 5 years ago, and the fourth of a remarkable series of novels that started with Amy and Isabel in 1998, and which then followed a few years later by Abide With Me. All these books have resonated with readers and with reviewers, and from Amy and Isabel, which received the Los Angeles Times Art Seidenbaum Award, on through Olive Kittredge, which received the Pulitzer Prize, which this year's version just got awarded a few days ago. But Olive Kittredge was, in its time, a widely acclaimed recipient of that award. And she's also been a finalist for the Orange Prize, which is a sort of the preeminent prize for books by women writers, and numerous other the Penn Faulkner Award, and numerous other things. So tonight, though, we're going to get a chance to hear her talk about The Burgess Boys, which is a book set in our present time. But this book, though it certainly carries much of Maine as her other books do, also has a fair amount of New York, has a little Arizona, and other parts of the world are invoked very much in this book. In fact, there's a very central part of this book involves of Somali inhabitants of Maine. So we'll get to that in a little bit. So with that, I now ask you to please join in welcoming Elizabeth Strout. You're welcome. The first thing she will do, actually, we'll do a little bit of a reading, but yeah. You need a book, you can use this. Yes. You know your way. Okay.
But I also want to thank the library and also the wonderful... to me, the combination of a bookstore and a library getting together is just kind of perfect heaven. But so thank you, and thank you for coming out tonight. I'm just going to read ever so briefly from the very beginning of the prologue and then the very end of the prologue. And I've never written a prologue before. And I kind of can't get over it. I mean, I'm not saying that it's so good. I'm just saying I can't believe I wrote a prologue. So, okay, this is just the beginning. My mother and I talked a lot about the Burgess family, the Burgess kids, she called them. We talked about them mostly on the telephone because I lived in New York and she lived in Maine. But we talked about them also when I visited her and stayed in the hotel nearby. My mother had not been in many hotels, and it became one of our favorite things to sit in a room, the green wall stenciled with a strip of pink roses, and speak of the past, those who had left Shirley Falls, those who had stayed. Been thinking about those Burgess kids, she'd say, pulling back the curtain and looking toward the birch trees. The Burgess kids had a hold on her, I think, as a result of the fact that all three had suffered publicly. And also, my mother had taught them years before in her fourth grade Sunday school class. She favored the Burgess boys. Jim, because he was angry even back then and trying to control it, she felt, and Bob, because his heart was big. She didn't care much for Susan. Nobody did, far as I know, she said. Susan was pretty when she was little, I remembered. She had those curls and big eyes. And then she had that nutty son. Sad, I said. Lots of things are sad, my mother said. My mother and I were both widowed by then, and there would be a silence after she said this. Then one of us would add how glad we were that Bob Burgess had found a good wife in the end. The wife, Bob's second, and we hoped his last, was a Unitarian minister. My mother did not like Unitarians. She thought they were atheists who didn't want to be left out of the fun of Christmas. But Margaret Estifer was from Maine, and that was good enough. Bob could have married someone from New York after living there all those years. Look what happened to Jim marrying that snob from Connecticut, she said. So anyway, this narrator and her mother go on about this, and now just at the very end. And so it began, like a cat's cradle connecting my mother to me and me to Shirley Falls, bits of gossip and news and memories about the lives of the Burgess kids supported us. We reported and repeated. I told my mother again about the time I had come across Helen Burgess, Jim's wife, when they lived, as I once did, in the neighborhood of Park Slope in Brooklyn. My husband and I one night found ourselves dining near Helen and a friend in a Park Slope cafe, and we stopped near Helen's table as we were leaving. I'd had some wine, I suppose that's why I stopped, and I said to her that I'd come from the same town Jim had grown up in. Something happened to Helen's face that stayed with me. A look of quick fear seemed to pass over it. She asked my name, and I told her, and she said Jim had never mentioned me. No, I was younger, I said. And then she arranged her cloth napkin with a little shake and said, I haven't been up there in years. Nice to meet you both. Bye-bye. My mother thought that Helen could have been friendlier that night. She came from money, remember. She'd think she was better than someone from Maine. This sort of remark was one I had learned to let go. I no longer bothered myself with the defensiveness of my mother and her Maine. But after Susan Burgess's son did what he did, after the story about him had been in the newspapers, even in the New York Times and on television too, I said on the phone to my mother, I think I'm going to write the story of the Burgess kids. It's a good one, she answered. People will say it's not nice to write about people I know. My mother was tired that night. She yawned. Well, you don't know them, she said. Nobody ever knows anyone.
Thank you. Before we talk so much about the book, which I think we'll mostly what we'll do, could you talk a little about how you work? Have you worked with the editors?
Right. Well, the role of the editor is, you know, it's a big deal, frankly. And it's changed, I guess. I hear this from other people since I've had a rather steady thing. And, you know, those of us who write so steadily and so fervently always sort of think of Maxwell Perkins and the, you know, the old days. And it's I think that's not the case for many people, although it certainly has been the case for me. I've been very, very lucky to have Dan Menaker from the very beginning for my first three books. Dan and I shared a common sensibility, so I always felt that when he suggested something, he at least understood what I was trying to do with my work, and that was very, very important. I'm also obsessively a perfectionist, so I don't hand something in until I think it's perfect or as perfect as I can make it. And so Dan and I, you know, the little bit that we would go back and forth on, we had a lot of respect, and it was a very meaningful thing for me to understand that he got what I was trying to do. And then he left publishing, and I had a big fat old, it wasn't old, it was a big fat new manuscript of what was to become the Burgess Boys, and I had a brand new editor, Susan Camel, and I'd never met her. And she was absolutely lovely, and she came over and she talked to me about the book, and it really, really, really was not ready. And I wasn't quite sure why, and she had all these different suggestions, and I kind of thought, I don't know that that's the problem. But we talked, and then she did this incredibly brilliant thing that a very good editor will do, which is she left me completely alone. And it was wonderful because she gave me the freedom to go back and figure out, and what I figured out was that the voice needed to be redone. Mm-hmm. And I think very often people don't understand how important the voice is, that you have this relationship with the voice when you pick up the book and you begin to read. That's your relationship with this narrator. And you don't even understand consciously, nor should you have to, that something may be going wrong in the sound of the voice. And so you start to think, well, this or this maybe is wrong, but I think it's the voice. But she was, I feel so grateful for that trust and that freedom. And it's like any other relationship you've got to have. You got to trust the person, and that's not always easy.
You've talked a little about working with Dan Menaker coming into this. You're not a product really of a writing program, and you had a whole other life and work approach before this. You were not a kid when Amy and Isabel got published. Can you talk a little about...
Right. I was not a kid when Amy and Isabel got published. I was 43, far from kid-like. Well, I was kid-like, I'm sure, but I was far from... I shouldn't have been. But I had actually been writing for years and years and years, ever since I was young, but I did not go to any writing MFA program. I didn't... I studied with Gordon Lish, for those of you that might know. That was pretty scary, but he left me alone, and I learned a lot. But that was really the only time that I... took outside instruction, so to speak. But I began to send my stories to this fellow named Daniel Menaker at The New Yorker, and that's when I realized that he got my sensibilities, because he would write these little rejection notes, and I thought, oh, he gets what I'm trying to do, and then the rejection notes would get bigger. And I'm such a slow writer. We're talking about like 2 letters a year that I was like, you know, so excited about. And they'd get longer. And then, you know, one time he called me up and he said, no, I'm not accepting it. I'm like, that's okay. It's just so nice of you to call. And he just was very encouraging. And then when he moved over to Random House and, you know, we ended up that way. But I did work in solitude, but a writer can't work completely in solitude, because you're writing for a reader always, or at least I am. And so, you know, if Dan was the perfect reader for a number of years, then that worked. And
I just now put together, you went to law school in Syracuse, yeah?
Yeah.
That's also a place where a lot of serious writers are. And
exactly.
I don't know if you were picking up on what was going on there that way.
I went to law school because I thought I had to earn a living, you know, and I did have to earn a living at that point in my life. I did. One does. Let me just say that. So I was still writing all the time, and I thought, well, I have a social conscience, and I like words, and I'll use words, and I'll make the world better, and I'll be a writer at night, which, of course, was terribly, terribly young thinking and very misguided. And I got to Syracuse, and I didn't even know. I'm sitting right next to this writing program, and I dropped out of law school after the first semester, and I thought very seriously, because I hung out with the writers. I didn't hang out with the law students, and I thought very seriously about going to the program. But then I realized that I could get the benefit of just, like, hanging out with them, because they weren't doing any more writing than I was. I mean, I was writing just as much as they were. So I went back to law school, and they continued on with their MFA. But it was, you know, Raymond Carver
were writers?
Was there.
Yeah,
Raymond Carver
Ray
was
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Tobias Wolff just showed up as I was, you know, we overlapped a couple of years. So, you know, I had access to all of that without having to show my work to anybody in a workshop.
In The Burgess Boys... it's a novel that's got several aspects to it, but it's certainly a story of two brothers who have left Shirley Falls, a town in Maine, and are both actually in New York, and they both are called back for a family situation with their sister. And one of the things that comes out in the book right away, there's 3 siblings, but there's all this very interesting adult sibling work. Right. So say a little about that, if you would.
Well, it took me quite a while to figure out exactly why I called it The Burgess Boys. And I always knew that it was going to be called The Burgess Boys. And when I know something that with that much certainty, there's usually a reason. I don't often feel that certain about much of what I'm doing. But it's First of all, because it was the relationship between the men. They're grown in the whole book. They're grown. And it was their relationship that was the most interesting to me. But really, their relationship as adults is so informed by this tragedy that took place when they lost their father in a car accident. All three kids were in the car when they were little. And so they talk to each other. Their way of communication remains that of little kids. The older brother being very scathing and, you know, bossy and kind of what it would appear to be awful, but Bob lapping it up, the little one, you know, younger one, lapping it up because it's attention and he just adores his older brother. And so they're boys, mm-hmm. but they're men. And so that's what interested me about it.
And then, but there's the part where they left Maine.
Yeah.
And have gone, I mean, there's this part which, so it's not, in a way, they're pulled back to being boys, but there's another part of being pulled back to their town.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the boys have escaped this. Jim's become a very, you know, famous lawyer and a very good lawyer, and Bob's a okay appellate lawyer, and they've moved to New York, as people do to, you know, to get away. And yet they've left their, well, I can't say they left their sister behind. She was never going to leave. You know, every family has some people that stay and some people that go and whatever. And Susan was going to stay. It was just in her nature. And she did stay. And then her son does this terrible act of throwing a frozen pig's head through a mosque of the new Somali, relatively new Somali population that has come into town. And she is out of her mind with anxiety and fear, as is the kid, because he really doesn't quite get what he did. And so she calls her brothers. And, you know, it's like, help me, help me. And they're her brothers. And so up they go to try and help this situation. And that's, you know, just, you can imagine these three grown siblings are not particularly pleased mm-hmm. with each other. Never have been.
In this book, I mean, you've written about Maine in each of the books now. I'm recalling correctly, this book has Maine dealing with the larger world in a different way.
Yeah.
Not just Somali, but even Sweden is because of... And so...
You're such a nice reader. Oh. You got to Sweden, right?
Yeah, it does.
You are.
Could you talk a little about... because this is a part about those small towns where you don't think you're ever, you know, it's so hermetic, and yet... And yet you have the world coming there, and that's partly what the son is dealing with, and suddenly there is this community there that has a different and is played out because the characters are also in New York. They're sensitive to some of it there.
Right. So my take on Maine was larger, I think, or went a little deeper than just, you know, Isabel Goodrow in her office room at the factory, which was right at her time in history and stuff. But this time I'm sort of taking on Shirley Falls and with the history of how it was a mill town for many, many years, and for 30 years those mills have closed, and it's become a town where there's great unemployment, and the Somali population that had originally come into Portland, Maine to try and live there, after having had to leave their own country, and most of them coming from the camps in Kenya, after many years getting over here finally, find the rents in Portland, Maine to be high, because Portland's a nice little place. People want to live there. So they found this town. This is in real life I'm talking about now. They found this town about 40 miles west that was safer, and the rents were cheaper. And so it's been quite a surprise for Maine, which is the whitest state in the country and the oldest state in the country, I think, still, and to have this darker skin population move in. And so that was very interesting to me, to try and capture this. You know, obviously this is happening all over the country, but because Maine is where I'm, you know, from, and it's more familiar for me, it was very interesting for me to take that on.
So could you say a little more about Jim and Bob and their role when they do come back to town? One of the things they're trying to do is help the son with his legal dilemma. Could you say
This is one of the fun parts of being a novelist, because in real life you take this act, which was just, you know, reprehensible and violent and extremely painful to the community, and you look around, you think, okay, what do we have as a society? What tools do we have to speak out and speak up and say, well, we've got this law, we've got this law, we've got this community service, we've got this. How can we best organize? How can we best rise up and respond to such an act to make a statement to the town, the country, the world, that this is not going to be tolerated? So you've got that, which is very interesting to me. But then as a novelist, I get to sort of take on everybody's point of view, so I don't have any agenda. So whatever my Liz Strout response to this would be, you know, gets to just go and sit on a shelf for a moment, because, you know, then there's Jim Burgess, who's very liberal, and Bob is very liberal, and they come up here, and of course, if it hadn't been Zachary, they'd probably be ready to, you know, prosecute fully whoever had mm-hmm. done this act, but it's their nephew Zachary, and that's life, isn't it? I mean, it's a mess. I mean, life is a complicated mess. So they've got to come up there and find themselves in the, you know, in defending an act which they find abhorrent, but he's their nephew, and they feel for him because they know what a bad knock he got in his own way, and so they're in this complicated thing, and of course they mess it all up. Because, you know, because I wrote the book.
As you say, this title is The Burgess Boys, but there is a sister, Susan, who is a really interesting character in the book, because she, first of all, she's the one with the problem, having the son.
Right.
Say, because she has stayed in that town. In fact, you know, she actually makes a big journey for her
yes.
later in the book.
She certainly does.
And kind of movement in her.
Yeah.
Say a little about...
One of the things that is very important to me as a writer is time and place and how that affects our character. We are all born in a specific time in history, and we are shaped by the place that we're born in, and develop in. So when we're talking about, I think I'm getting back to your question, if not, just ask me again, but one of the things that's very interesting to me about this being set in Maine, for somebody like Susan Burgess, these events happen in her childhood, and it is not talked about. Now, in another culture, it would be talked about and talked about and talked about and, you know, all sorts of, you know, whatever, but it's not talked about, because that's what happens in Maine. Something happens to you, the town understands it, they absorb it, and they move on. So Susan has lived, and that follows her, that sense of isolation, because when her marriage breaks down, and you mentioned New Sweden, because she married a man from New Sweden, Maine, and they were originally the settlers that brought in, the people who lived in New Sweden were brought in by the textile owners, mill owners, to have white people work in the mills, because they didn't want the French Canadians coming down to work in the mills. So there was, you know, this whole history that goes back to that. So Susan happened to marry this man from New Sweden, who decides, as people do, well, you know, I've got some ancestors back in Sweden, and I'm really sick of you, Susan, and I'm sick of Maine, and the house is always cold, and this kid turned out to be such a weirdo, and I'm out of here. And he goes and lives in Sweden. And so Susan's had a hard time. And she's very isolated with this. And her kid is kind of a weirdo. Because sometimes kids are. And, you know, not diagnosably, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but just old-fashioned weirdos. And, I mean, there isn't enough said about that anymore, because everything has a diagnosis these days. But some people are just different. And Zach is different. He's just kind of different. He's out of it. But he's not evil. And Susan has tried her best under these circumstances. So, but when you look at families, you think, how in the world, well, maybe you don't, but how can they be related? Even though you get how they're related, you think, but really? Like, I mean, you know. And there's a there's mm-hmm. a connecting thread, but it's just always astonishing to me. And I understand that, you know, there's all sorts of gene pools and parents behave differently to different kids, and there's a billion reasons why, you know, but it's still odd, and there are just some people who mm-hmm. stay home and others that run away from the very same family. It's her nature. That's what I meant when I said it was her nature.
Throughout the book, what happens between the brothers, not only in Maine, because there is that the whole part where they kind of go back, but it includes New York and includes other things. How do you know so much to write about brothers, what happens between them?
Well, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't quite know. I do have a brother, but he is very much a Maine person, and we don't talk a great deal. It's not acrimonious, as far as I know.
But the brothers are quite virile. But that would be, because they've left? I mean, or would they,
yeah,
would they have been?
Right. Well, I had to, one of the reasons I had to leave Maine is obviously I talk too much.
Yeah.
So, that took care of me, in my own family. But I don't know. Siblings have always, only have that one, and I've never really known him that well. Siblings have always interested me. You know, I have a friend who has two sisters, and I just like, tell me what you did. You know, and they visit and they invite me along with them, and I'm just like, you know, interests me. But those are sisters. I don't know where I got this sense of brothers. I honestly don't. I wish I did. That's such a dull answer. I don't know.
But the book bears out otherwise. I mean, that you do know things. Yeah, that's good.
I know something, but I don't know what I know.
Yeah,
right.
That's the mysteries of all this. I don't think you've written it like you have in this book about a group of others, especially the Somali community, and you both give the sense of them as other as the town perceives them, but there are some individuals, and especially the man Abdi Karim, who has a role in the book as it goes along, especially relative to what happened with Zach, and assessing. He seems to see what's going on with Zachary almost better than anyone else.
Well, he's suffered so much. He's gone through so much.
Yeah. So can say a little about how do you have your own experience with?
Well, that was the biggest decision in the book, was whether or not I was going to try and take on the point of view of a Somali man. That was really pushing my imaginative powers. But I felt like if I didn't give. And also a woman I do as well in there, but mainly it's Abdi Karim. And I thought, if I don't do that, they will remain the other. And that's not what I want. You know, I'm trying to get in there. And so it took me a very long time, and I did a tremendous amount of reading and talking to people, and I got a book of 300 Somali proverbs, which I was so excited about. I mean, I was just almost pathologically excited about that. And you know, just everything, and used whatever avenue I could to kind of talk, but not hopefully, you know, rudely, you know, to make my way through to try and understand what that experience could possibly be like. And, you know, I know that, like, I'm a white woman in a country where that historically has given me a lot of benefits, and yet as a person there are certainly many, many times that I have felt very weird, very other. So I had to use all, you know, you have to use whatever memories you have of being alienated from the culture that you're living in, and just push those as far as you can.
When you're writing a book, or both writing a book, or then later when you're done, do they feel connected to your other books?
They do, kind of. And I think and now that I have four of them, I realize they're all sort of a piece. Although I understand that this is larger, I guess, I hopefully, because I'm getting older, and you know, and I've lived in New York long enough now to be able to write about it. Apparently, instead of just staying in Maine, I got myself down the coast in my work. And I, you know, keep bringing back Shirley Falls, and I sort of have little characters that are related to each other, if you happen to notice. But if you don't, it doesn't matter. But I get a kick out of it, you know. So,
I was noticing. That's why I was asking a little bit.
Yeah, it just makes me feel cozy to have all my little chickens, you know.
And in the writing of the book, is this now four books long? Is it becoming? For you, the word predictable probably wouldn't ever apply to writing a novel, but is there some order, is there some way you're going at it that doesn't feel like you're making the whole thing up?
Yeah.
You know the more what you're...
No.
Okay. Yeah.
No, each time I just can't believe that I've ever written a book before. It doesn't feel like I have. And I think, but you did. See, they're right there. You did. You should be able to do it again. But I don't ever believe that I can. And I never know what will happen.
Yeah. I think we should probably open this up and see if others have questions. Is anyone ready to ask about either Burgess Boys or any of the other books?
The question was I wrote my first novel at 43, and was I working on it? What made it happen? And I'd been working on it about 40 years, really. I'd been working from a very young age to be a writer, and I just didn't really tell people about it because they just, you know, look at you with such embarrassment for you. You know, it's like, really? You want to be a writer? And maybe that's not true out here. I don't know, but it's true in Maine and New Hampshire. So I kept quiet about it, and I worked on it, you know, a long time, and I kept sending those stories to this guy, Dan Menaker. And so that book probably took me about 6 or 7 years to write, and then I couldn't get an agent. It sat there for a couple of years, and that was very depressing. So really, by the time it came out and it did well, and people were like, oh, overnight success, it was sort of like, okay, if that's what I'm supposed to say. But it wasn't an overnight success.
Another?
Yes. I'm very, very much from Maine. I'm so much from Maine that you will probably have to work hard to find somebody here before my ancestors were here. Yeah, exactly. That's a very good question. Scary question, but a very good question. She's saying, you know, since I'm the one who said that we're a product of time and culture, what has the culture of my extra Maine-ness produced in me? And I think, you know, aside from the mutation of talking too much and that, you know, that every gene pool has, you know, some sort of thing go wrong, I think it's given me a sense of hard work. You know, that work ethic is like, that's what you do. You work. And it really wasn't until I moved to New York that I found out, oh, people eat food to enjoy it. I didn't know that. I'm not kidding you. And I haven't quite gotten over it. Seems a lot of fuss just to eat something, but, you know, but nevertheless, you know, anyway. So I had to fight that sense of there's a lot of, like, anti-pleasure. You know, you're not supposed to just have a good old belly laugh. As a matter of fact, I don't really know of a relative of mine that's ever had a good belly laugh that stayed in Maine. So there's a severity, a very harsh moral judgment, very, as far as I'm concerned, which I love. That's one reason I love being a novelist, is get rid of all that judgment that I grew up with. It's just, you know, you're supposed to be like this. So that's what I've kind of grown up through, the barnacles of that, and, you know, but how do you ever know who you are? You don't. You haven't a clue, really. Yes. Yeah, how long did I have the Burgess Boys in my head before I started working on it? The reason I can answer that is because I happened to find, rather recently, as I was going through old manuscripts to throw them out, I found that I had actually been thinking about that. I knew that I'd been thinking about them for a long, long time, but I actually found a scene attached to an Abide With Me scene with Tyler Caskey as a minister, has this car pull into his driveway with these three little kids and this hysterical mother because her husband's just died. And obviously, I was, you know, compelled by this scene and clearly figured at some point that they had to be two separate stories. So it goes back at least that far. Yes. Right. The question is, what's my relationship to short stories and to literary magazines and sending out stories to literary magazines? I cut my teeth on short stories and literary magazines. So I think they're great. And I would read them. I still read them, but not as much as I did. Because that's where it's happening. You know, that's where people are learning. That's where, or, you know, and you've also got some people who have learned a great deal in their publishing in there as well. But you get to see there's a certain element there in those literary magazines that I don't know where you find on their own. So I think I always found them to be a wonderful source of, you know, to give me a sense that I was writing for somebody and also to see what was coming back at that time. And I still do. And I still do stories. I like stories. Yes. Yes, I've lived in New York about almost 30 years, and 20 of those years I did live in Park Slope. So I haven't lived there for a while, but it seems to take me a while of living in a place before I can write about it. So yes, but I did. I lived in Park Slope. So the question for those that you didn't hear, the fact that I studied gerontology years ago, did that inform how I treated Olive Kittredge? I don't know if it did or not. You know, I was always very interested in elderly people. I don't know why, except for the fact that probably because I had tons of elderly relatives that, you know, lived on this dirt road, and they were just so unpleasant. And, you know, you just always, you know, you feel whatever. I don't know. But so I was off kind of, like, interested in helping older people. And I don't know. So I really don't know if it informed it or not. I think that with Olive Kittredge, it was, you know, more a question of allowing her to be a real Olive Kittredge and trying not to protect her, because sometimes she would do things and I would think to myself, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I can have her do that. And I would think, but she would. So do it or find a different job. You know. Yes. Right. The question is talk more about the business of the prologue. I've always had a little bit of a prejudice against prologues. And I always told my students, I don't know, be careful about that. And especially if you put it in italics, you know, the eye is going to be all busied up and, you know, it's like this. It's the first relationship that you have with the reader. And I think that the reason that I always had some question about a prologue is because it can be misleading. It can make you think, well, here's the relationship, here's the voice. This is, you know, you're settling in, you think, well, this is what it's going to be. And then all of a sudden you open the next page and it's like, oh, now here's the, you know, when you've already settled in. And so that has, I think, you know, I want to have that initial relationship with the reader to be an honest one from the get-go. And so I don't want to be fooling, you know, I don't want to be, you know, pulling you around and, you know, just being cute or messing you up or anything. So I think that this, I just wrote it, it felt natural. I thought, well, I won't throw it away quite yet because I throw things away pretty, you know, a lot. And I didn't throw it away. And then it seemed to fall on my ear in an acceptable way that kind of, you know, because it's related to that sense of a small town, and it's related to leaving. You know, when you leave, you talk to those that you left behind. You know, so in that sense, it seemed to me to be true to the story, because it connects you, always looking to be connected. Yes. Well, I think this is a little bit what's in the Burgess Boys. I mean, that we do in our, you know, in our young, you know, maybe young or older teens, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, we think, I'm out of here. And you actually think you can do that. And, you know, so it takes you a while to realize, I can't believe it. I'm still me. You know, and that stinks. So then you have to deal with that on a whole nother level. And so I think that's a little bit what the Burgess Boys, they, you know, particularly Jim, thought, I got this licked. I got it licked. I am so out of here. And I've got some nice clothes, and I got nice kids, not weirdos like Zach. And don't bother me. But, you know.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Yes, people do. So there you go. It doesn't matter. You're going
to
forget it anyway.
Do you hear it read again?
Oh, well, thank you.
Back to where it started. It was like, oh, yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, so many people have said,
Bob, what a great
oh, character. I'm so glad you like Bob. Oh,
he's so lovable.
I'm so glad.
Fabulous.
Oh, thank you. I love Bob. I do.
Is he Bob?
No. He's my husband. But he's not Bob. He's not Jim either.
Thank God.
I know. Somebody said to me the other day, I see your husband's name is Jim, and you've got this character, Jim. How does he feel when he reads it? And I said, he doesn't feel anything because it's not him. But, yes. The theme, you're right, there is that theme. And the theme comes organically. I'm conscious of not approaching the page with an agenda. So what comes up there is like, is very much from my subconscious. I mean, I certainly consciously arrange the sentences, but it's much more like giving you privy to one of my dreams or something. Then I'm not going to go to the page with an agenda, which is why I made Zach such a confused person, because it would be so much easier to have him just a racist jerk. Well, where's the story there? We all know that, you know, that's just one more awful story. So, you know, for me as a novelist, I'm just always looking to not do that, to sort of write against the grain, but then, you know, the alienation and stuff comes up because I think most of us, in different ways. Yes. What writers do I read now? What writers influenced me in previous years? Well, I read like crazy starting when I was young, just like went through everything, and so I sort of, not everything, obviously, that's such a false statement, but you know, I just remember chomping my way through, you know, starting with Updike, I think, because he was around the house, and so I was very young when I was reading Updike, and then, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and D.H. Lawrence and Virginia Woolf, and just being amazed and just feeling, you know, just that thrill of, you know, and the Russians. I love the Russians. Learned so much from the Russians. I think from contemporary writers, probably Alice Munro and William Trevor ground me the most at this point in terms of, you know, just, but there's a lot of stuff going out there. George Sand is amazing. What he does is like so different. You know, Nathan Englander, I think he's really interesting stuff. Yes.
Full disclosure, I'm a Somali.
Full disclosure, I'm a white person from Maine.
I'm okay.
No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to joke. I'm glad that you're here.
So, you know, the main characters are both lawyers and you have a law degree. Did that influence, you know, part of the selection, that you have a law degree and you kind of gravitate toward...
to a criminal situation?
Yeah, kind of litigate the case, you know, with two lawyers because you have a law degree.
Well, I will tell you that when I was in law school, aside from studying gerontology, I was always drawn to criminal law. And I knew that about myself. It's like I must just always want to defend the criminal in me or something, because, you know, what we do for work is always a little interesting, I think. And I have always been drawn to criminal law. So it was probably no mistake that these brothers were both criminal lawyers, because that's what, you know, it's that aspect of society that interested me. Well, as a writer, do I look for subjects that I'm very familiar with, or do I explore other things? And that's a really good question, because, you know, they always say to writers, write what you know. And I think there's a lot to that. And I think that we know a lot more than we think we know. But I think if we stay with familiar territory, there's an awful lot there, I think, that can be used. But, the older I get, the more I realize I can branch out. This was a big deal for me to try and take on, you know, a culture that was not familiar to me. But I wanted to, because I'm so interested in it. So I think it's more like what interests you. You know, it's like, what is it that you really want to know is probably the most important thing for a writer to go to the page with.
Maybe do one more question.
Okay.
Is there one?
One more? Why do writers like New York City? The question is, why do writers like to go to New York City? And I can only speak for myself. I don't know that many writers in New York. And I know Susan, my editor, but I just don't really hang out with writers, or almost anybody. But I always wanted to go to New York because I really like to see people. I love I love to ride the subway. I think that is just so fun. I mean, it's not that I go out and just ride it for fun, but if I'm on the subway, I just think to myself, this is so cool. Look at what is in this car. There's this, 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 and this, and we're all stuck in this little car. I mean, so I love that about New York, and I'm sure other cities have it as well. But and everybody, before I moved to New York, people said, oh, it'll kill you. They're so mean and cold. Huh. Try living in Maine. I mean, New Yorkers, I think, are very nice. And my experience of New York has been, if you want to have a conversation when you leave your apartment, you can. And if you don't want to, they could care less. And that's perfect for me.
Okay, thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.